Welcome to another episode of the Newer Tech People podcast, part two of our Tech Exec series. And on today's episode, we have Victoria Aspden, Executive General Manager, Digital and Transformation at Amp Control. Welcome, Victoria.
Thank you very much.
For those of our audience that don't know who you are, can you give us a bit of an overview of who you are and your career to date?
Yeah, absolutely. So I work for Amp Control. I moved up to Newcastle just over a year ago. I've 18 years in Australia, all of them in Sydney before I came up to Newcastle. Started my career. I started in technology because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And at 18, I did a gap year and I really enjoyed traveling. And I knew that traveling also needed money. So at that time, it was all going to tech. Tech's got money. And so this was back in 1999. So I was like, okay. Good advice. Thank you very much. So I started with my degree. I actually didn't have the right grades to get into my course, but the lecturer told me afterwards that he liked my application and my email address made him laugh. So I got accepted into that. Then also after university, I went into KPMG, a similar story. So in order to get to KPMG, you need to have an A, like 16 years old in maths and all of those things, because it's an accounting firm and I didn't have that. But the recruiting partner at the time said, well, I'm getting all these really smart grads coming in, but they can't build relationships and they can't, you know, and as a consultant, that's so important. So he tried recruiting a different way and did an ad just open for grads. So I kind of got in through the back door at KPMG as well. And when I was reflecting on how to kind of summarize my career, almost every step has been somebody taking a chance on me where I didn't quite fit in the mold, where they said, let's give her a go.
Yeah.
And I just think, you know, first of all, it's the, if someone takes an opportunity, you know, gives you an opportunity or takes a chance on you, you know, prove them right. So really make the most of it. And then how can I pay that forward and give other people those chances as well? So, but after KPMG, I moved to Australia as part of a KPMG secondment. And then I was at CBA, so Commonwealth Bank of Australia, for over 14 years.
Wow.
Somehow.
There's three little parts there I want to dig into right away.
Sure.
First, what was this email address that made him laugh?
I was like, do I tell this story? Yeah, it had the word goddess in it. And that just seemed to make him laugh that I would put that on the university application. And again, yeah.
Very nice. Second part, I think what you hit on just there, like, obviously, we work in the recruitment game, and recruitment can be quite a rigid process sometimes, depending on who you're working with and which company. Mm. I love the idea of looking outside the square a little bit. Mm. And from a recruitment perspective, we like to look at, hey, what are those core things you need for a role? And then where is their flex?
Yes.
And that ability to flex, and you can get somebody that comes from a different point of view or slightly different background maybe than you expected. But if you have a look outside the square, that can bring different viewpoints and that can really have success in a role.
Yeah.
So I love the fact that you were given those opportunities, but then that's been part of your career now, and imagine how you build your teams.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's been a number, you know, even though I've always worked in IT, I'm not technical. Now, what anyone terms as technical completely changes. I've worked with like the most technical people I can think of, and they'll always find someone else and they'll go, oh, I'm not technical, though they're really technical. But that's been really interesting to navigate through my career because it has often been looking at a problem in a different way, but also really respecting those technical expertise and me not trying to do those technical expertise as well, which people tend to enjoy. Like people, if they're an SME and something, they like to be respected as an SME. And they tend to also know their own limitations as well and go, well, I'm really good in the box, but hey, these business people, they make these decisions and I can't make head and tail of them. And I'm like, well, I can help you with that.
Yeah.
Let's kind of break that down.
And then you have more success by surrounding yourself with them, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and I'm always just amazed at what people can do as well. So it's that genuine, you know, appreciation. And who doesn't like to feel appreciated when they come to work as well? So yeah, just different ways of looking at the same problem and you can get, you know, much different outcome.
Yeah, I love it. The third point you made mention of was the communication piece. And I guess you mentioned it there again with problem solving, but you got the role in KPMG because they were taking one lens look at it, the technical lens, but then your communication skills, especially in the consulting world, I think it also it obviously works in consulting, but more the further you go up in the hierarchy and the chain, that consulting piece, that ability to communicate, problem solve, just becomes more and more important.
Oh, absolutely. And that's been really interesting where there was a particular point in my career where I was really stagnant. In fact, I took a career break and I studied filmmaking at NIDA for a year. I just wanted something completely different. But it was really interesting because I actually learned, you know, on a set, you know, it's a really strict hierarchy. Roles and responsibilities are really important. Like there were so many parallels to my kind of boring life in IT and financial services. But what really changed and why I came back into it. First of all, filmmaking makes no money at all. And you have to just drop whatever you're doing. It doesn't matter who you love or whatever. If you've got an opportunity on the other side of the world, you just have to go. And that just wasn't for me. But it was whilst I had the break, there was a restructure back at CBA and these new roles were created where it's more end to end as opposed to in a silo. And so I came back into an end to end role. So like a mini CIO role. And I loved it because it was that end to end. I didn't need to be a technical SME in any particular area, but I needed to be able to problem solve, communicate, collaborate, all of those things. And then suddenly it was just so much more engaging. It was like the human part of the tech, which I'd always been the thing that had drawn me. So yeah, it's interesting. Like you say, and I found that each time I get more senior, I'm like, oh, this is even more in my sweet spot. Yeah. This is great because I literally have teams of technical SMEs to support me. So
yeah. You think that the filmmaking skew, the creative outlet outside of work has given positive influence, like on just the other, you mentioned the communication skills, but...
Oh, absolutely. How to tell a story. Like everything is about how to tell a story. If you've got a project, you've got an incident, like how do you start from, you know, everything's a hero's journey. Like what is it that we're trying to do? What are the barriers in our way? And how can people help you get to the end outcome? So yeah, it was actually really amazing, the parallels. And I think it's, you know, when I decided to do filmmaking, I thought, wow, this is so left field. This is so different. And I was like, actually, this is really similar. I see a lot of parallels with, you know, the things I enjoy to date. So yeah,
I completely love it. I think storytelling can be one of the biggest strengths or one of the biggest skills people could learn, especially early on. You're telling a story to apply for a job, why you're the best person for the role.
Absolutely.
You're on the client side, you're selling a story on why somebody should come and join you.
Yeah,
you're fighting for a budget, or if you're fighting for a project to get over the line or approved, it's selling the story, right?
Absolutely. And when I think back, when I have failed, when something hasn't gone right, it's generally, yeah, I didn't tell the story well enough. I didn't bring people on that journey. And I know that's like an overused phrase, but people want to be part of something. And so telling that story and it making sense to them. And it's also that people need to, this is what you find when you're writing stories. It's show, not tell. So if you tell a viewer what is happening in the story, they disengage really quickly. They like to feel like they have discovered it for themselves. So when you're telling the story of what you're trying to do, having people go, oh, I can help. Have you thought about this? And then they feel part of it too. So it's all of those similar elements.
I think it'd be a great thing for people to learn. Technology professionals in general, I think that storytelling aspect is such a great skill.
Absolutely. And it just makes so much more fun and engaging. You feel more connected with everybody. And yeah, it's great.
The connection piece is big there. You mentioned that twice. The connection piece, making people feel part of it. I love it. Sorry, Dave. I knew I was going to go down tangents. So we're at KPMG and then you're looking at CBA.
Yes, yeah. So what I found, what I really liked about being a consultant was that variety. So, you know, you rock up to an entirely new location. And I was like, this is before Google Maps as well. So just getting there would always be a challenge for someone with my spatial difficulties. But it was all new culture, new place, you know, new business model. So that was really interesting. But what I didn't like and what really drained me was coming in, telling everybody what was wrong, going away again, coming back a year later, being like, why didn't you do all those things that were so good on paper? So when I was at KPMG, I got a secondment at Commonwealth Bank in insurance around customer retention. So I actually ended up having operational accountabilities. And I loved it. I loved being responsible. I loved it being end to end. And I was there for over a year and a half. And at the end of that, I was like, oh, I can't go back to being a fly in, fly out kind of worker almost from a consulting point of view. So then I joined CBA and yeah, loved it.
Yeah, nice. I think the consultancy piece, and it's the same with agencies, I think it can work with some people. They love the, hey, I'm working on a new project, new company, new
no problem to solve.
all the time, and it suits some people, but the people that like to see something through from go to woe, get that sense of achievement at the end of a project. I think that internal aspect can sort of mold into that as well, right?
Absolutely. And I think also starting my career in consultancy, because I was often positioned as an expert and I knew I was not. Now, obviously, I had a team of partners and, you know, directors behind me, but I always had this thing of, oh, I haven't actually done the thing that I'm advising you how to do. And so I just wanted to have that experience as well. So, yeah, having that, feeling that credibility, I guess, was
a
important.
Little bit behind it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's it.
And us. And then the CBA journey, how was that for you?
Yeah, look, so I was largely in the wealth management arm and, you know, a lot of change in wealth management while I was there. So we had enforceable undertakings. There was obviously the Four Corners on Common Shore at the time. And then I moved into advice, obviously all of the advice remediation work as well. And then I moved over to Colonial First State, which is superannuation, which is then when we got bought by a private equity firm based in New York, KKR. So many different projects and types, like merging and then decoupling, acquiring, remediating, growing. You know, it's almost every combination you can think of a business challenge where tech is a part that I was part of, which I had no idea when I was like, sure, I'll go work in, you know, in insurance and kind of build on it. So yeah, that's those 14 years went pretty quickly in the end, I think.
I think that's an interesting point. When people have a look at their careers, is like, if you stay at one place for too long, you could be stale. And I think it can be a very naive view. There are some people that do stay in one organization too long and they do become so. It can be a thing. But if somebody's given new challenges, new roles within an organization, there's got that continual progress. Is it that continual progress, the continual challenge that kept you there for so long?
Yeah, I think so. And also the sponsorship as well. So it was that, oh, you've done a good job on this. Now we're going to give you another, you know, something more complicated. So it was that feeling of that you're building your reputation and the challenge as you go. It was also a really great culture. I mean, you know, whenever you're in a big organization, there are things that frustrate you. But CBA generally really invested in their people. So there was a lot of training and coaching and around the softer skills as well. There was a thing that unfortunately they don't do anymore, I believe, that it was called Comm Leader, where you'd go and you do like the LSI framework and you do it as a group and you'd really analyze kind of your strengths and behaviors and all of those things. And it was, I said to my sisters, this is like free therapy. Like you'd really, you know, it was whatever you made of it, but it was such a growth journey that CBA would take you on. And that's really what kept me there and helped build that culture as well.
I think the growth, you mentioned it, is there. It's such a key part of any organization, it's a part of any recruitment process, part of keeping people engaged while they're there. As long as people feel like they can grow, or if they're going to leave an organization, go somewhere else, it's the opportunity to grow. I think it's that internal driver that people have. It can be one of the biggest motivators for people to either stay with the company or leave.
Absolutely. And it was really interesting because there were a number of people at CBA who'd been there a long, long time. And when I were in some of them that I would manage, and I would see all of their potential and their smarts, and I'd talk to them about, you know, what's your next challenge? But there was such a fear. Like there were so many people who were too afraid to try something new, and they'd got themselves into a very safe position. And really early on in their careers as well. And I go, gosh, if you're scared now, how are you going to feel, you know, when you're in your 50s or whatever? So it's really trying to get that balance right between safety and challenge. And, you know, you can be in the terror zone for a bit, but not for too long. But if you're in the comfort zone for too long, you forget what you can do. So really trying to mix that up, I think it's important.
On that point, if you're talking to somebody right now and is in that safe zone or very much approaching the safe zone, the bend too long. Any advice that you give to people beyond just, hey, just take a risk?
Yeah, look, and it is a lifestyle choice as well. So I will say, you know, some, and I really like it when people are honest with me and go, look, you know, I just want a steady income. I want to know that I can do 9 to 5 and it doesn't take up any headspace for me in the evenings or the weekend. And I'm happy with that. I'm like, good on you. Like, you know, your priorities. So that's really good. But I do then worry how safe they would be later. Yep. So, you know, when you're, if you're having to make hard choices and change your business, it is often about flexibility of skills as well. So it's that cool, but keep yourself safe. Like, do keep, you know, different certifications, do try different projects. Like, even with that comfort zone, just get yourself out of that a little bit. But if you're in your comfort zone and you can feel it and you can't quite get yourself out of it and you're not too sure, I think really, you know, you've got to do that reflection time. You've got to understand what's important to you and what interests you, and then you can seek that out either as networking or courses or just approaching someone in your organization and going, hey, I think you're great or interesting, or I really like to talk about the project. Could you spend me half an hour and tell me about your career or whatever it might be? Everybody loves that, and it's just that first step to do something a little bit different. So yeah, I think it looks different for everybody, but you got to know what's really important to you, because people can tell if you fake it.
Yeah, well, and it can be like, it's the mentorship, right? Whether it be like an official mentor or somebody unofficial, it's just approaching that person. And as I said, most people will give that time of day.
Absolutely. I can't think of any senior leader who would say no. Even if they were awkward as hell while they were doing it, they'd still do it.
Especially if approached with that genuine nature that you mentioned. So somebody coming at it and they're not smelling bullshit. They're actually saying that you are genuine about where you're at in your career and you've got a potential concern or question for them. And if they get up, they will.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, obviously engineering is very different to financial services. But I haven't worked anywhere that you'd get knocked back.
Yeah.
And if you did well, to find someone else, because you got the one bad one.
Yeah.
You try.
There's another point you mentioned there, and I do love it. I think the way I look at careers, I think there's seasons. So I think there's a season for running hard. There's a season where for other aspects in your life, you might need that 9 to 5 or that little bit less stress for a period of time. I think there's that season where you can't run 110% all day, every day, for 10 years straight, that you do lean to those burnouts. But it's that acknowledging there is a time and a place to go hard. There's that time and a place where you might need to do 60 hours a week to get a project over the line or to progress from one role to another. But there's also another time where, hey, for whatever reason it might be, lifestyle decisions or other things happening in your life, it's okay to actually take that step back, still achieve what you need to achieve. It's not being lazy. And it's still looking, as you said, about progressing other certifications. But being okay with, hey, this is a season for me to take a breath.
Yeah, I love that. And I think, you know, like say, when people go, oh, I'm being lazy, rest is important. In fact, rest is critical. I say you can't go at 110% sustainably. You will burn out. You will make bad decisions, either personally or professionally. Like, that rest is needed, and you can have kind of micro rests or you can have macro ones. Like when I took my year off to go and, you know, do filmmaking, like, but you can do anything kind of in between as well. So yeah, being kind to yourself, I think, is really important.
I love it. I love it. CBA, 14 years.
Yes.
And was from there to Amp Control?
I went to Great Southern Bank in between, so a Brisbane-based customer-owned bank. So I was with Great Southern Bank, so I looked after the customer and enterprise platforms. So that was my first time looking after tech that is really customer facing on a really consistent basis. So when I'd looked after it in insurance, it was like one element of the big CBA monolith. But at Great Southern Bank, it was all of the digital platforms that were under my remit. So that was from a cyber outages and some real legacy tech there that we needed to remediate as well. So that was, you know, an extra level, and that was really fun and challenging too. But then for personal reasons, we moved up to Newcastle, and then, at that time, Amp Control very luckily was looking for somebody with my kind of skills, real cultural fit. So when you're saying with from a recruitment and UE tech people perspective, I think Linda really did go, feels like you're this kind of person, so let's kind of put you two together. And it was, you know, for me, when I met the CEO, the chief people officer, and our CFO, it did just feel like, it's like I'd already known them. So that fit was wonderful, and very, very lucky with timing as I came up as well.
A people element, I love it. And I think it's really important at the moment. We're talking about AI in every which way, shape and form, right? AI comes up in recruitment, comes up in every industry. That people element is so important, and we'll never get change. We'll never be influenced or overly taken over by technology. You can skill match on paper. You can look at motivations. You can do alignment. You can even go as far as like psychometric testing and making sure there's alignment and everything. But there's a people element and making sure that that is a fit, how comfortable you are, how comfortable you feel in that environment, because you could have the best skills in the world, but you come in, hey, this doesn't feel right for me. So I think that that human element to it is still so important. We're in technology, you're working, you know, the digital space, but yet the human element was a key driver for you, right?
Absolutely. And I think AI is a really interesting one, because absolutely, it's like we've had this massive leap of productivity in skills that comes from AI, but we've had those before. And I always think back in the 50s when the washing machine was invented. And if you look at all the adverts at that time, they were going, oh my gosh, what are the housewives going to do? They're just going to be hanging out all the time. Like everything is so great. But by bringing in washing machines, then the standards went higher. So, you know, maybe they washed their clothes every 2 weeks before, but now everything needed to be sparkly white and fresh and ironed and all of those things. So the domestic labor continued at exactly the level it was before. It's just the standards got higher. And I think that with every productivity tool that we see, I mean, if you were the only company who had it, yeah, sure, like off you go and everyone, you know, you only need, you know, a tenth of the people, whatever. Well, because all your competitors are doing it as well. Like you're all just trying to race. So it's this race of productivity. So I think AI definitely, of course, changing the nature of some of the skills, but at the heart of it, it feels the same to me. And I remember when, you know, we first see a co-pilot generated PowerPoint, for example, and goes, oh my gosh, can you believe this was created in 30 seconds? Now we've seen a few of them. I'm like, yeah, I can believe that was created in 30 seconds, because there's a whole lot of waffle in there and images that don't really match it. And you've kind of lost the story. And it feels like bullshit bingo in terms of like, you know, business phrases that all sound impressive. But you're like, but what are you actually trying to say? So once we get used to that and you can start identifying that kind of AI generator stuff, the value of that goes down. And then, like you say, you need the humans to either train the AI to get the quality out there, but it's all about context. And if you don't have the right context, then it's always going to land flat. So, yeah, I think we're going to, obviously it's changing things, but yeah, I think we're in the hype cycle.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's happened again, as you mentioned, with different technologies throughout time. And the best people will be, or the people that succeed the most will be the best people who have that context and are able to use the tools to your advantage. So the best people, if they become good at the tools, will become even better because they become more effective, more efficient. But you have to just embrace those tools and roll with it. But it won't make somebody that doesn't have that experience, doesn't have that context, significantly smarter. If somebody uses AI to write how to grow a business that never grown a business before.
Absolutely. Because, you know, there's the information is already out there. It's the practical application of it that's important. So, yeah, those skills are still needed.
I love it. I'm going to come back to Amp Control in 1 second. The role before Amp Control, you went in for the first time. You had, you mentioned architecture, you mentioned security, you mentioned having that customer-facing journey the entire time. I imagine there's a few skills there that you didn't have. For somebody that's coming into a new environment and having to work and work around all these new platforms, new technologies that you might not have had to have that full ownership of before, how do you go about that? Is it surrounding yourself with the right people? Is that how do you go into that new environment, take sort of stock of where it's at, and then start how to grow?
Look, I think being honest is really important. And so, for example, there was a peer head of, and he'd been there a long time and he'd done all of the core banking. And so being able to go, hey, this is my experience. These are the things that I know. I've not seen this before, though. Can you explain that to me? And then, you know, obviously you need the credibility. They're not going to teach you from scratch. But being really vulnerable and honest, but also sure in my own experience. And I go, well, yeah, I've not had it for that specific thing. But, you know, I've done similar things before. So any questions that I ask probably aren't going to be ridiculous. And then I find that people are really generous with their time and helping, you know, explain, because they want you to understand. Because if you don't understand, if you pretend that you know it all or you don't want to admit it, you're going to either make strange decisions or you're going to, you know, go in a strange direction. So, yeah, just genuine curiosity, openness, be confident that you are the right person for the role. No matter, you know, as long as you haven't lied on your CV, and everyone, you know, beefs up a little bit, but as long as you haven't completely told any whoppers, like you're going to be the right person for the role. So yeah, just being curious and open and going, hey, this is something that's a bit different to what I expected. I'm going to need some help.
Yeah, you don't have to be the expert in everything.
No, that's it. And honesty is just the best policy, and do that nice and early, because if you wait and it festers, then it's going to become a much bigger thing later.
I like it. So PIN services, consultancy, PIN services, banking. Engineering.
Yes.
New challenge, completely new environment. Talk to me about the journey so far at Amp Control. What's the same? What's different? What's the biggest challenges between an old engineering company that's been around for quite some time? A lot of success there.
And
the PIN services background that you've come from, I'd love to know. What's the biggest challenges? What's the biggest changes, differences? What's your experience like?
Absolutely. Well, I've really loved it, which is lucky. I find from an engineering mindset, like it just makes sense. Like they feel like my people, and that's probably the best way that I can describe it. And I go, well, yeah, I've always been working with either software engineers or tech engineers. So, I feel at home there. It is a challenge, though, because obviously I'm coming from big organizations with well-established, you know, risk frameworks and solution delivery life cycles and all of those things. And I've got incredibly smart engineers who just in their nature want to break stuff and put it back together again. So when you try to say, hey, this is the way it's done, it's always a, is it though? And I think there's a better way to do it, which is wonderful challenge, but also when it's a, yeah, but it's tried and tested and let's just try the basics. But I actually love that. So it's the, I'm bringing red tape by putting in more control and like lifting up maturity. And I have to be so good at telling the story and demonstrating the value, but then also in certain times just going, look, this is just the way we're going to do it. And then let's just see. And you can tell me later that that was a waste of time or a mistake, but you've got to build credibility and trust in order to do that. You can't do that with everything. I've loved the ability to take what I've learned and then put it into practice and be able to cherry pick all the things that have worked for me and put the things to a side that I'd inherited and didn't like. That bit has just been joyous and so satisfying. And sometimes that struggle makes it even more of a win at the end when you go, no, this is successful, and you hear the mindset changing as well. I did wonder how it's going to go with changing in the industry, but it's, you know, people are people. We generally, like, the similarities far outweigh the differences, which is great.
Is the biggest change just the pure scope and size? Obviously, you mentioned CBA, you're working in a part of a monolith, and then you've gone to another environment where it's a bit smaller and you have full ownership of it. Again, that's smaller again, where you've got full ownership across the whole remit. Is that the biggest change just to that size and scope and scale?
Yeah, it's interesting because the parts I worked at CBA, they were different businesses and they were all about 1,200 people. So Commercial was about 1,200 people. So was Colonial First State. So I'm used to companies that are that size, but being part of a much bigger parent.
Yeah.
That over the top goes, thou must. So not having that is a blessing and a curse. So some of the things you go, oh, the frameworks don't exist. And oh, when I say these words, not everybody knows what I mean. And I've certainly found that with, you know, some of our bigger programs where we go, oh, yeah, cool. And then afterwards I go, oh, no, they didn't know what I meant. And actually that's a whole learning and department that kind of doesn't exist here. But yeah, then it's also the bits that didn't make sense for a company of our size that you had to do because you were part of that parent company. I think that's really frustrating. So I've just got deep joy of not needing to do those things, of taking the best bits and not having to do the bits that don't make sense for us.
Are you able to move quicker because of that?
Yeah. And that's actually another thing as well. Like, we're very action oriented at Amp Control. Like, we are problem solvers. We are ready to fix things.
I think it's within the DNA of Amp Control, right?
That's it. It's just like, ugh, let's make a decision and move forward, which is wonderful. And there's, especially doing a transformation, there are some decisions that would have taken, gosh, if not 6 months, a year at previous financial services organizations, because it is a change in policy, a way we're reporting, you know, all of those things. But at Amp Control, it's like, okay, yep, got it, let's do it. I'm like, wow, we got a decision. That was only like 2 weeks ago. That's amazing. And, you know, it's all the pre-work that you do before that, yep. But you go, wow, that's great. But then we have to keep a watch on ourselves. And we talk about that too, and going, okay, do we understand the problem we're trying to solve before we go to try and solve it?
Yep.
Have we all got the same opinion about what the problem is that we're trying to solve as well? So trying to get that balance. And I think that's the same with any company, right? Because you could sit there and you could navel gaze and you could get lots of reports before you make a decision, or you can kind of go too far the other way. So that's a really interesting journey.
Yeah, the alignment piece, I think we see that a lot of the time. If we get that alignment at the start, everything moves so much quicker afterwards, and we all have the same idea of what success looks like once that alignment's sort of at the start, as opposed to a little bit disparate views, and then we start moving and then figuring out that different people are looking at it from different
ways. Exactly. And you're like, oh, I thought you meant that. Hang on a minute. And that's when you know, people get so frustrated because they go, but we agreed. We're in a room all together. We agreed. You're like, yeah, we use the same words, but they all had different meaning. And now we've got to unpick that.
And this is this communication and storytelling part again. The other part is obviously moving, Sydney, Brisbane, now Newcastle. What's the different challenges than you've found in building a team in Newcastle versus building a team in Sydney and Brisbane?
So Sydney, and Brisbane, though Brisbane's smaller than Sydney, so it's a bit kind of in between almost. Actually, maybe it's pretty similar to Newcastle.
I think there's similarities.
Yeah.
Definitely close similarities between Brisbane and Newcastle, and Sydney's a completely different beast.
Yeah, I think so. Because, you know, in Sydney, if I go, right, I want to get an expert in this, you know, I will have so many CVs of people with exactly the kind of skills that I was looking for. Whereas in Newcastle, I need to, like we were saying before, be much more specific about what's the core thing that I really need.
Yeah.
And those soft skills are, you know, maybe not the number one, but they're certainly the number two in terms of how does the person collaborate and be part of a team, be vulnerable with things they don't know. And, you know, all of those things, those skills become really important. So that's where, you know, that word of mouth has been really interesting with how I've built my teams.
We do a good job in Newcastle and get that talent like yourself. Come in from experiences outside and then come back to Newcastle. You get people from Newcastle on a tech perspective, might have done their degree here, done some early years here, gone away to a Sydney International, somewhere else, then come back. And it's great to get those different experiences that come back to Newcastle and then help level people up.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I've got a bit of a mix. So my enterprise architect, he's Sydney-based. Poor guy comes up the highway a lot. And interestingly, he was from CBA and we'd never actually worked together, but I knew of him. And supremely well regarded and was often on the stage, you know, talking about different successes. And so when I was recruiting for an enterprise architect, it was actually a mutual now friend who had been a colleague but had become a friend. And he said, I'll use his name. So he said, oh, you know, Neil McKellar was interested, but oh, the you know, he doesn't want to move to Newcastle. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, the Neil McKellar might want to come work with me at Amp Control. I was like, oh my gosh, can I at least, you know, give me his number and let me have a call. And we got on like a house on fire. And, you know, he's at a similar stage where he's worked for these big companies, but just it's the joy of the doing and the fixing of a problem and, you know, and collaborating that really drives him. And so, you know, he comes up, you know, to Newcastle all the time to help us untangle what has been zero enterprise architecture kind of ever in the 50 years of Amp Control. So his, you know, external insights and passion, together with the teams who have been there for longer, like it's a really great mix. So it's trying to find that balance.
Oh, and there are times where you have to have that flexibility. As you said, you've said it a few times, flexibility in how we go about getting the right person. And it might be, hey, having to get somebody that's a little bit outside that can't be there day in, day out, but can come in, you get that particular expertise that you wouldn't be able to get somebody sitting here. You made mention then enterprise architecture. You've come in, Amp Control is on a journey, like all organizations, but you've come in from a maturity perspective. I imagine they're more immature than some of the more complex or those large organizations you've been in. Can you just talk me through that journey of coming in somewhere and implementing things like enterprise architecture and looking at those, you know, maturity levels and maybe how quick you can move on that journey?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it's been really interesting to come in and introduce something like enterprise architecture. And I think I would have struggled if it hadn't have been with engineers because they love the problem solving and the logical way of breaking down a problem. So the structure that my enterprise architect has been able to put in, they are glad that it's there, even though they might want to go to the next level of detail of, well, what does that really mean for me? They kind of respect that logical framing, which is really great, which maybe in a different industry, it would just feel like PowerPoints. And, you know, I just need you to tell me if I can choose that software as a service. I don't need to tell you. I don't need you to tell me how you got there. Whereas in the engineers, like, tell me how you got there. And then, you know, I'll buy into it. But it is a lot of unpicking of things. And it's really testament to App Control's culture that they allow themselves to be vulnerable in that way and going, yep, we made a decision. And now you've shown it to me that way. That doesn't look like that's the right decision. And we'll unpick it. Whereas in other organizations, they can just hold on to that and just fight the process because they don't like the answer that's coming out of it. So that's been extremely helpful as we try to create those frameworks and just work out the different problems to solve. But it's interesting. So we've been there, myself and my enterprise architect, for about a year now. So you get the first kind of quick wins, like the obvious ones. They're still massive in terms of impact, but they're kind of obvious. You go, this just needed a common sense view and a structure, and everybody, like, what you're saying isn't very controversial at the end of it. Everyone goes, oh yeah, that makes sense. And oh, it's a good news story. And actually, we don't need to replatform something, etc. We are now going to get into the harder problems to solve that will have controversial outcomes and will impact people in different ways that they don't like. But you've got to build that credibility as you get to those, and everyone to understand that there's no agenda here. Like, architecture is a mirror. Like, it's a, hey, here's the different options, and these are the decisions you need to make, and these are the consequences of those. And, you know, enterprise architecture has to be incredibly neutral in that way. And so once you've built that trust up, then people can go, okay, well, this outcome feels hard, but I understand why we've got there. So, yeah, that maturity journey is really interesting as we go.
Yeah, I love the two pieces. I mean, like, get the early wins on the board. And I think it's best with most people. There's always some low-hanging fruit. You come in with fresh advisor. I get some easy wins. Build that credibility. But then also the other part you mentioned there is that culture. I think you mentioned it a couple of times. App Control is really great from that cultural perspective on the ability to change, the willingness to go on that journey, the vulnerability. And I think that must make your life significantly easier, having a culture that actually embraces that, as opposed to, you're always going to face pushback from time to time, but having a culture that actually can go on that journey with you.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I really believe in the spirit of App Control. Like, it's just all of these brains, these wonderful intentions, like, there's a real sense of purpose there. And so when you've got that, you can connect people with those common goals to go, hey, this is what we're trying to do. This is the best thing for App Control. And I've needed to give it numerous hard messages of, hey, no new software, because we're transforming, hey, I'm going to freeze this, and hey, I'm saying no to that, and all of those things. But as long as my logic is sound, they've gone, okay, like, that might be to my face. I'm sure someone's complaining in the background, but, you know, they're not escalating and doing it anyway. And, you know, all of those things, which, you know, I just think is incredible. So yeah, I feel very lucky to be part of it.
Beautiful. You mentioned new tech. As a technology executive, I imagine you have to stay abreast of new technologies. You have to stay abreast of technology trends. You might not have to be the expert in every single technology, but from your perspective, how close do you stay to technology trends? What's your current, I guess, view on things that might be coming or that you might be looking to implement down the track?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, my biggest thing is problem before solution. So I am much more interested in understanding problems in new ways than I am about the new solutions that are coming. So that's something that, you know, where I have my architect and others in the team where they go, hey, you know, there's, you know, Microsoft has done this new thing with AI because we're, you know, a Microsoft shop. Great. Do we understand the problems that we're going to apply that to, or are we going to get super excited and just start doing that for kind of tech's sake?
Yeah.
So I'm definitely more on the problem side than the solution side, because that's where I find the biggest wins are. And often it's some really simple solutions that make the biggest impact. But what I am really liking is, you know, the trends towards low code, no code, that our business areas are starting to, you know, equip themselves with language. They understand the value of things like out of the box, which when I started my career 20 years ago, you tried to talk to people about out of the box, you'd get phrases like, oh, it's the tail wagging the dog, and like, how dare you? And all of those things. Whereas in now, usually through pain, people have discovered what it's like when you do customize a system or you inherit a customized system. So I have, you know, my business people going, no, I must go out of the box. And sometimes I have to bring them back and go, it's okay to do a customization if it's going to bring business value.
Yeah.
Again, if you understand the problem, then we can look at, you know, what either does or kind of doesn't fit into it. But yeah, just the fact those low code, no code platforms is actually really helpful because you don't need to have that depth of technical expertise to be able to give solutions to some of those problems. So you can just really put your focus on the analysis part rather than the tech build part, which I think is the right balance.
Yeah, I think it's finding that right balance, as you say. Mm. You mentioned just before, not re-architecting the entire platform for the sake of it. Let's talk like, where are we at now? What problems is this going to solve? And then let's look at maybe the right solution. And the out-of-box solutions are getting better and better and more customizable or plugging different ones together to get a solution. And we've seen a lot of people do that really successfully as opposed to one big platform coming in. You can look at customizing the edges or plugging a couple of different systems together to make it work.
Perfect. Customization now means something very different to what it did when I started my career. We're no longer talking about someone actually just building code themselves. We're talking about, oh, we've got this additional element that is really high configuration that may break with an upgrade as opposed to only one person understands how this all hangs together.
Oh, yeah.
It's in a language that no one uses anymore. And like, it's very different. So, and I think that's really interesting when I'm working with the business and because they have gone, oh my God, anything that's not out of the box, which is absolutely the right principle to have, but to go, look, there's different grades and you actually need to assess it as we go rather. Yeah. It's a principle, not a rule.
Yeah. So. And what's fit purpose now? Might be fit purpose in the future, but if you're making a decision now which could ruin the future or make that significantly harder, might be the decision like, let's go to the light version now. We'll build a couple of APIs between a couple of solutions. It works for now, and then we'll look at how that serves its purpose in the future.
That's it. As long as you document why you've done it and how it all hangs together, and you know the dream state is that all of that logic is really clearly kind of documented. So if one of those things change, so if your risk appetite changes, your scale changes, your strategic direction changes, you can go, all right, well, what does that impact? All right, now I can see that. That's the dream. And that's where, you know, that next level kind of an incredibly mature enterprise architecture piece will be able to do that because you can't future-proof systems. You have to make decisions to go in certain directions. And I think that's what I am really enjoying about Amp Control. Amp Control is pretty strong at making those decisions. When I was part of big financial organizations that just kind of just kept making money, they were very reticent to make a bold choice going one way or another. It was just kind of, no, I'd like to do more of the same, please.
Yeah.
So that is much more thrilling to be part of.
I like it. And you mentioned from that technical side of things, I guess you stay abreast of technology, but you lean on your expertise for there. Hey, this is the new tool. Here's how we might be able to use it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like to me, it's generally the understanding of the problems we're trying to solve and how they're interconnected. Those are the most uninvested parts. And if you spend the time really challenging yourselves on that, that brings dividends.
We've talked about enterprise architecture. We've talked about lifting the maturity. Are there any frameworks that you use all the time?
Yeah, absolutely. There's three particular phrases that I will bore the pants off anyone who works with me around. So the first one is problem before solution. So that, whilst not a framework, it's a mindset. So really understanding your problem. So doing, you know, the five whys, fishbone, like whatever you need to do, really understand that before you go to the solution. I get really twitchy when solution and problems are all combined because we all fall in love with solutions because we like that action. So that's a framework or a phrase or a way of thinking that I use a lot. The other phrase or the framework is people, process, tech, data. Use that constantly in terms of you can't impact one without impacting the other. So again, the problem solving, people going, oh, I'm just going to tweak this. Oh, can IT just sort it out for me, please? Also IT going, oh, I've got this new update and oh, I've just pushed it without letting you know what's happening, drives me bonkers. So you can't make decisions. You can't work through any kind of change without thinking about all four of those. And always one seems to get forgotten. So that's really important. The other either phrase mindset that I use a lot is talking about the cone of uncertainty. So where are we in terms of our certainty? So we go, yeah, you've got your big ideas and you're figuring it all out. And then you get more certain as you go. And that's really important to go, where are we with this? Because there was a lot of angst at the beginning. And they go, because people are worried that they think they're at the corner edge where we're about to implement, but actually they're really early. And so really understanding that as a framework and how it feels to be at different parts and how you move yourself forward is really important. It's also what I find people can deal with this, that cone in different ways. So you have people who are really comfortable with the pointy end and will be able to go through every detail and make sure, you know, nothing will break and it will work. They tend to go crazy if they are up at the top where we're going, oh, it could be over here, it could be over here, it could be a car, it could be a tree, like nobody knows. That drives them crazy. And the same ones where the people who love the, is it a car or is it a tree, go crazy if they try and go into the corner when we're actually implementing. So understanding where we're at, the right level of skills for that particular point, helps me navigate a lot of change. And there are individuals that can go from big to small and back again, but they're unicorns. Like generally it's people feel comfortable on kind of particular wedges as well. And there's many who like the middle, but like you do all the big stuff where it could be anything and nothing kind of makes sense. Everything's up for grabs, but oh, don't make me go through all of the detail too. So yeah, that those are my three phrases that I bore everybody with all the time.
I feel attacked.
Really?
The detailed stuff. I love the uncertainty. I love the ideas. When we're getting to the, you know, the data, the intricate details. I'm bored.
Yeah.
Or it just doesn't.
Yeah. And it's amazing when people will go, oh, but why? God, they're so detailed. I'm like, they're going to save your life. Oh, like, when we're implementing, they are going to save your life. And then the same thing, the detail guy's going, oh, they're all up in the, you know, big ether and it doesn't, you know, it's just nonsense. It's just PowerPoint. Like, we have to do that in order to deliver the right thing. So it's actually feeling confident of, oh, it's a different mix of skills. It's not, if everybody was like me, everything would be perfect. No, we need a really good mix. So I find it helpful to have those conversations.
Yeah, I found that from a business perspective. Linda and I are business partners, but are very different in that way. Linda's attention to detail is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Mine not so much. So surrounding yourself with the right people has been very beneficial.
Absolutely. You got to get it complimented, which is great.
I love it. I guess that feeds right into the educational piece. Question I've always asked on this podcast, a question I think I always will continue to ask, is the importance of education. We've talked about before continual growth, and we'll dig into that part secondly, but you did do a degree at the start, university. The university game is going to continue to change as education continues to change. Did you enjoy your degree at that time? Would you encourage others to go down the degree path now? Is it one size fits all, or is it?
Oh, look, it's really hard. And I've got three boys. They're very young. They're, you know, at least a decade away from needing to make those kind of choices. But it's so different to when I chose, like the level of investment now. It's, and I really feel for universities, the position that they've been put in as part of that. I did enjoy my degree. I didn't love it. I did a master's, though, in digital culture and communication at the University of Sydney. And that was about, you know, my tech background with my sociology interest. So I did sociology, you know, at the HSC level.
Yeah.
And I loved it. You know, it's so interesting when you look at privilege and, you know, all of those things. So I absolutely loved that. So my master's was actually a social science degree talking about how does digitization and technology impact society. And oh my God, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I've never got better academic marks than I got on that master's because I just wanted to absorb it all. It brought me such joy. And it was really interesting because I chose my degree from a very practical lens, my initial degree, to go, I want a skill that makes money. And so I'm going to go into technology. It was a, yeah, I'm doing this because I need to, because this is a path I want to go on. Whereas in when I actually did my master's and I loved it, I thought, wow, what could have happened if I'd loved my degree? Like, what would that have unlocked?
Yeah.
So it's really hard to navigate, you know, those paths. And I think really, you know, from a practical perspective, because I was looking for a very practical skill, if they'd had the kind of apprenticeships that are available now, then maybe I would have been better going down that path.
Yeah.
But what I think you get from universities that you don't go that way is confidence.
Yeah.
So you are literally learning from, you know, certified experts, and the level of confidence that you get with using the models and using the language, I can really see the difference with people that I work with who have or haven't done that.
Yeah.
And there's almost this, I'll say insecurity a bit, where they go, oh, but you know, you guys went off to university and you've learned all these things. And it's just like, yeah, you could get it. Like, there's nothing that's mysterious as part of it. So yeah, I think that is really important. I've certainly seen that. My husband, who's a civil engineer, he got a master's in town planning, for example, and he'd always been working in planning, but his level of confidence and his career went zoop when he did his master's in planning, because he went, no, I do know the best way of doing things. And this model is the best way. And just that confidence that you bring. So, yeah, look, I'm a big supporter of universities. It's just, financially, it's a real tough decision for, you know, a lot of people and a lot of families.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that the core concepts that you can learn and the frameworks, we'd definitely say with technology professionals, the frameworks that you can learn, security again, core frameworks that you can then build upon. I think that that basis that you can learn in a university can be really beneficial. Mm-hmm. I also think it's a funny time in your career, right? When you're making a decision about your career potentially at the ages of 17, 18, where... where let's say we're not all overly mature at that stage or making right career decisions. So
that's it.
But the ability to actually just enjoy that experience and learn to learn, learn some core concepts and that just evolving life. I mean, you might get some more clarity through that 3-4 years on which way you want to go, as long as you come in relatively open-ended.
Absolutely. Gosh, if I think of the almost social mistakes I made at university, that if I'd gone straight into the workplace, you know, it's such a wonderful experience to come together with, you know, a group of people your same age and kind of navigate and work out life together at that stage. Like, it's really special.
Well, it's your first real independence, right? Because you're making a decision whether you're going to class or not, or a tutor or not. You're making a decision around it as a being told by a teacher or in a schooling environment where it's quite stringent, right?
Absolutely. So it's really magical. I just wish it was more affordable and accessible for everybody.
Yeah. Nice. We'll go down the continual education path for a second. How do you, for your career, continue to grow externally? Do you look at, you know, podcast books? Do you look at a master's? Do you look at formal education certifications outside of it? How do you, you know, continue to progress your career?
Absolutely. So I think, gosh, was it 2 years ago now? I did the AICD, so the director's course, maybe 3 years. And that was fantastic. That was like a mini MBA in a week. It was, and the way they write the material, because it, you know, I think board paper reading language is like 14 years old or something like that. So there's no terminology in there that you have to like know. Like, it explains really complex concepts in a really easy to read way. I remember one part where it talked about that risk and strategy are two sides of the same coin and you can't have one without the other. Blew my mind, because I'd always sort of, oh, strategy's over here and then risk is down there and they're telling us what we can't do. I'm like, no, of course these are the same choices. No risk without reward. So it's those kind of things and those kind of courses. And really that was word of mouth, you know, with other peers going, oh, it was great, you should try. And obviously, you know, when you're thinking about progression, you're thinking about board and things like that. So I keep an eye out for those really interesting courses. But being the mum of three kids, I don't have that much discretionary effort either to give. There's a course I'm trying to do at the moment and I've put it off, oh my gosh, for at least a year and a half. And it's all about finance, which, you know, coming from an accountancy firm and working financial services, I know the basics, but still it's not my like native language. So I thought, you know, I'm replacing an ERP. I want to be able to have more confidence when I'm thinking about some of these concepts. But oh my gosh, it's so hard. Like, it's all of the pre-read and the, you know, the Zoom calls at night and all of those things. Like, it's really tricky. So I think once life gets a little bit more stable, I'll look to those again. But it really was a lesson to me with both the filmmaking and my master's are going, but choose something that I'm really, you know, that brings me joy and interest.
And this is the part I was about to come back to, the passion part. You mentioned you were really passionate about the second time you went through the degree and you did better because of it. I think I see professionals who are passionate about what they do, who have some form of genuine interest in what they're doing. They tend to succeed in their careers, right? Or fast track it.
Yes.
Is the advice just in general, follow something you're passionate about? If you're not passionate about it, do you have to change your career? What's your, you know, not everyone's going to get their ideal job where they're doing exactly what they want to do 9 to 5, but how can they weave passion into their job? Or This is
exactly, exactly. And I think the more you know what you're interested in and what drives you, so what motivates you. So, for example, I know I need to get deliverables. Like, I know I need to get the feeling of satisfaction of something being done. So I did a number of years looking after IT strategy. I did not have that sense of accomplishment. So, like, know the things that give you energy and the things that drain your energy. I think that's really important. And then, yeah, those topics that you find really interesting, when opportunities come up, either internally or externally, you'll go, ah, no one else is going to think that's cool, but I think that is so cool. And I really want to give that a go. And someone will go, oh my gosh, you love this? Okay, go for it. Like, I've got someone in my team and she's actually in undergrad at the moment. And we have a thing called operational technology, which is obviously the tech that we put out in the field. And we've been wanting to look at this for ages, but it's really complex. And it's been in my, really want to do it, but I just haven't got the headspace basket for ages. And then myself and this lady were talking and she goes, oh my God, I love OT. She goes, I'd love to do that. I'm like, you want to look in OT risk? She's like, oh my God, yes. It's like, please, please. That has been on the to-do list and I just haven't got the time to shape it. So her joy has been sparked. My joy has been sparked because something on my to-do list that I couldn't, you know, kind of get off it and now finally has some momentum. And so, yeah, it's like leaning into your weird. So when you go, oh, I don't know why I like this, and this is probably really strange, like just lean into that, follow that, learn more. It's amazing the opportunities that open up for you once you can actually articulate it.
Yeah. And be proactive about it, right? You mentioned there, it's somebody being proactive about sharing what they're passionate about, having that passion and starting the expertise. So,
people love to help people. Yeah. So you go, oh, great, if you're interested in that. And obviously, it was even if it hadn't have been a big thing that I needed to work on, I would go, yeah, sure, you know, go for it.
So, yeah. And again, so that's surrounding yourself with the right people. Like, it makes your life so much easier if you've got those right people around you, right?
Absolutely. I think, you know, that advice of hire people that are smarter than you, and there's definitely a vulnerability, you know, in that as well. Like, I have some extremely senior people working for me who have done, you know, my job, if not more senior, but it's like, okay, come in. I'm going to trust that, you know, they're here for the right reasons in their role, and they have just added so much value. So,
the right season in their life, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You mentioned just before you've got three kids, obviously, very senior role, a lot of roles, responsibilities, stresses, are challenges that come with that. How do you manage your life, headspace, mental health when it comes to that juggle?
Oh, badly. Really badly. Like, I'm very lucky, as part of our move, my husband's a stay-at-home dad, so that was part of the move. So before that, you know, I had the mental load of being a more present parent, or, you know, in terms of time. So it is something that I continually am working on, of how do I not bring all of the big problems that I'm trying to solve and be really present at home. I am finding, though, like, basically the older that I get, like, there's only, once you've been, you can't count how many red projects, P1 incidents and cyber attacks you've been part of. You know that it's going to get sorted one way or another. So, you know, you start to lose that, oh, but if I just worked on it for an extra 12 hours, maybe I would fix everything. You go, it's okay, I need to rest, and this is what's important. And then seeing how quick my children grow up. So I've got a 9-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 2-year-old. And I can, like, it was like yesterday that my 9-year-old was like a little baby. So I can already see how quick the time is going. So, yeah, just trying to really focus on being present, knowing that I'll do my best at work, it will be what it will be, but not having to go, oh, have I packed their lunches? Have I organized X, Y, and Z, which is what my husband is doing, means that I actually have a bit of breathing space. Whereas before we made this move, I did not have that breathing space, and that wasn't good.
Surrounding yourself with the right person.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I think that's a real challenge. And you mentioned experience part there. I remember the first time, you know, we're waiting on significant amount of money coming in and payroll was the next day, and staying awake until 12:01 a.m. refreshing the bank account many years ago, and going through those stresses. And then once you've been through it enough times, you find ways to understand that, you know, life will go on, and there's always a way around things.
That's it. And sometimes you do have to stay up to midnight because you're the one person who's going to bring it together. And then other times you go, especially when you get more senior, you go, well, I'm not helping anybody. Like, I just need to let the team get on with it. We've agreed when they'll give me an update. And you
get out of the way.
Yeah, that's it. Get out of the way. So, yes, that's important.
It's good to hear for everyone, because I think people face career challenges throughout their entire career, no matter what level you're at. Mm. And just like being able to hear from people that are, you know, more senior, that it can be a continual challenge, and it's something that you do need to continue to work at, because no one's perfect.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think spending the time that you can, whether that's through therapists or different tooling or whatever it might be, to understand kind of your triggers and your drivers is really important, because then you can know, oh yeah, I can feel I'm getting towards this certain way. I need to bring myself down, and I know what brings me joy and what can do that. So the more self-awareness, and really investing in that self-awareness, is really, really important as part of it as well.
Might be a difficult question. Any tips for people to get better at self-awareness? I think self-awareness is a phenomenal skill, and people that have it, you can see from a mile away. And well, especially if you're interviewing people that really understand, you know, who they are, what they're capable of, what they're not. They're the people that in interviews answer with, I don't know. And yes, they're the people that have those, but own it, have that vulnerability. But it is a learned skill, I think. I think some people it comes more naturally to, but self-awareness is definitely something that can be coached or learned.
Yeah, look, I think it's what you, first of all, you have to put yourself up for it. You can't get somebody to do it. So I really like the LSI framework. So that's where you pick like six people. They have to answer like 360 different kind of behavior questions about you. Be like, yeah, James is always happy, or James blows off, you know, flies off the handle at a moment's notice, and kind of you go, very much so or not at all. And then they build this profile of your behavior and your personality. And then they put that against the database of, you know, millions of people kind of worldwide. And they go, oh, you've got this kind of profile, and you've got green, which is, you know, you're a people pleaser and you're very conservative and all of those things. And then red, you're perfectionist, you're aggressive. And then blue is you've got the balance right. So that was what we did at Commonwealth Bank as part of this Comm Leader course. And, you know, it's really interesting because you go through that as a group. You can do it individual, but at CBA, you'd go through it as a group, and you could see the differences. And when you're presented with this information that you may not like, and I certainly did not like mine when I first came through, and it was a real surprise to me, you have a choice in that moment. And you go, am I going to say, this is all wrong, I picked the wrong people, they just did that because of that project, and kind of dismiss it? Or go, oh no, this model doesn't make any sense, and what about this, and that doesn't make, you know, la la la. Or you go, okay, right, I'm going to be vulnerable and really think about what's driving some of those behaviors and why I'm showing up that way. And you can go as deep as you want to. And like for mine, I was like, went into some real childhood stuff to go, oh, right, why am I doing that? And it's hard, right?
Yeah.
So you get big bonds on this particular course, because if you're feeling really vulnerable, you kind of all do it together. But that self-awareness that you come out with is really quite transformative as well. But you have to do the work, like you have to be really vulnerable, and it's scary, and you might not like what you see. So that has helped. That really taught me to stare into the bits that maybe I'm not so proud of, but to understand what's driving those. And then once you put it out into daylight, none of it's so scary anymore. So you get that shame kind of out of there as well. So that was a bit, and I really like that framework. But I've also tried to give it, you know, apply that for people in my team. And one in particular, it went really badly. Like the coach wasn't a very skilled coach. This guy went, gosh, everyone thinks I'm a really angry person, and just wasn't coached through it, and actually became a really negative experience, which was obviously the opposite of the intent. So you've got to be careful with it. But I think when anybody gets any of those kind of opportunities, it's easy to just go, oh, this is, you know, protect yourself and go, oh no, I don't need to look at that. I would embrace those. It's free therapy. It's, you know.
I think you mentioned the word vulnerability again, and I mentioned it quite a few times today. I think it's a really common theme that, you know, really, really brings true with who you are. And there's a lot of, you know, reasons that's helped your career. So I really love that today. I think that's, you know, some really great advice for other people to actually be vulnerable. It can help in a career, whether you're dealing with management, you're in an interview process, wherever you might be.
Yeah, wonderful. So, I love that, the theme. I like it.
The vulnerability piece leads into another question I do like to ask. Has there been a failure in your career that has changed who you are, or something you've significantly learned from? I think failure can be looked at very negatively sometimes, and it can be negative in the moment, but is a failure incident project in your career that has significantly changed or influenced you?
Absolutely. And I love this question. This is the hot tip for anyone who's going to be interviewed by me. This is the question that I always ask and never say you've not made.
Yeah.
Not made a mistake out of failure because, yes, you have.
Or it was somebody else's fault.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, the amount of times and go, oh, dearie me. So yeah, that's really important. That's how you grow. Like yeah. That's how, you know, innovation, failure, fail fast, you know, that's yeah. part of it. So when I think about, you know, and there's been heaps of things where I'd made an assumption and it proved to be incorrect, or I didn't engage somebody in the right way. Just so many. And I'll make more today, you know, like failure is constant. So like I say, changing that language to go, if it's out in the open, that's just, it is what it is. And then you move on. As long as the intent is good, then everything else will be okay. The biggest failure that I had, and it was very early on in my career, and it was the first time I was a senior manager, so managing a manager. And so my manager was performance managing one of the team. And I was aware of it. I understood the background to it. And, you know, and I thought that was okay. It was about a year and a half later that I found out that manager was actually really badly and publicly bullying that particular person. So, yeah, that's a big true failure. Other failures where I put in the wrong number in the spreadsheet or I forgot to do X, Y, and Z. I'm like, that's just part of learning. That one was a real failure.
Sounds like a failure early on in your career, which but it happened at that point in time, which has allowed you the opportunity to learn from that and be a better manager for the rest of your career and a better colleague. So I think it comes back to that whole situation of learning, you know, from an incident and then becoming better for it, right?
Absolutely. And I think I'll always be trying to make up for it. So it's not that, okay, done, I fixed it. It's like, I'll never be able to fix that. Mm. So I'll always be trying to make up for it.
And then giving yourself some space and acknowledgement that it's early in your career and you only know what you only know. Mm. And we all make mistakes. And if you can learn from it and be better for it, then yeah, it can be a beneficial thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love the vulnerability again on that project. And I think that would be the key theme that I've taken from today, so I really appreciate it. For those of our audience that want to follow who you are, your journey, your career, what's the best way for them to get in contact or follow you?
Yeah, look, probably follow me on LinkedIn. I will say I don't accept connections from people I haven't met, and this is kind of because scammers can create fake identities, and also, you know, I like to make sure that I know that the person is, you know, who they say they are, but they can certainly follow me on LinkedIn. That will be a good way to do it.
Nice. And thank you very much for your time this morning.
No pleasure. Cheers. Thanks, James.